We'll invite our tape ministry to roll the tape. And let me introduce myself. My name is Mark Schwain. I'm one of the two summer teaching staff coordinators, who along with my wife Dorothy Bass has helped to arrange this summer's teaching program. Delighted to see so many of you here, and gratified to see that so many of you are obviously interested very much in tonight's forum, which is organized around a very interesting question, which is this one: is Christianity the only true religion? I should explain, for those who haven't been ever to a Holden forum before, what we try to do in these evening hours together. Within the hour that we have, which I pretty strictly enforce from 8:30 to 9:30, we try to put up a question and open that question up. It's one that we never think we're going to answer or solve or resolve once and for all. Our best hope would be that the question would be sufficiently deepened and made further complex that it would continue to generate conversation throughout the rest of the week. And we chose this one largely because so many of the folks we have in the village this week are in one way or another involved in considering one or another aspect of this question: is Christianity the only true religion? And I'm not going to make elaborate introductions of the folks we've asked to start us off by speaking to us for 3 to 5 minutes on this issue to help us open it up. But the idea is for you to become involved and for you to participate and to bring your own questions and stories and angles of vision and concerns on this question. And hopefully an hour from now we'll all leave with thoughts and ideas and angles of vision on this that we didn't have when we came in, and can continue the conversation less formally after we adjourn. So all we ask of you is your attention and your participation. And let me just say briefly that we have to my immediate right Ron Young, and then Mary Boyce, and then Dorothee Sola, all of whom have been teaching this week and who will need therefore no elaborate introductions. So let me just begin by inviting Ron to start, and we'll move then down the line, and then we'll open it up for all of you. So is Christianity, Ron, the only true religion? He said yes, and then he said no. So.
I'll begin by saying that my own life experience has been one in which some of the most important ways that I have met God and or been met by God is in meeting other people, some of whom shared my Christian belief and some of whom definitely did not. They had other faith systems that they believed in, other faiths they held deeply, or held no religious faith as such. This is a very much a part of my experience, and I suppose a part of my bias, in an objective sense of bias, in answering and responding to the question. But I thought I'd do is share just a few experiences. I could not help this evening, sitting in this marvelous service with a focus on healing, of remembering about 9 months ago when I was invited to speak at Temple Bnei Jeshurun, Congregation Bnei Jeshurun on the Upper West Side of New York, where in the midst of a very long service,
3 hours,
conservative in style in that sense, a 3 or 4 hour service on a Saturday morning, the healing portion of the service was an absolutely central part and was very similar in both its form and its spirit to what was occurring tonight. I cannot in any way think that that is not a part of the same salvific work of God in bringing humanity into closer union and communion with God. A second experience is that I took our two sons, Jonah and Jamie, several years ago on a trip up to New England when I was invited to go to the groundbreaking ceremony of an Islamic center that was going to be opened in Sharon, Massachusetts. Sharon, Massachusetts, after it had been pushed out of another community where it tried to get some land. But in this community, in fact, Christian and Jewish leadership in the community cooperated with the Muslim leadership in finding the land and assuring the community's support for the purchase of the land, and this was going to be the groundbreaking ceremony. But on the way up, never having been to Plymouth Rock before, I thought, well, why don't we take in Plymouth Rock? And so we did, in the morning, visit the Plymouth Plantation. And as you may know, there's an enactment there. People act the parts of the people who lived there in the 1600s. And in one of the rooms we went in one of the cabins, a man was talking, and I asked him a question. I said, well, you know, you're talking about your group, your religious group that came all together. You're all of the same. But now you've said that some people have come to the plantation because there was a shipwreck offshore, and you rescued them, and you brought them to shore. I said, well, it must be that there'd be some people from other groups that would have come into your community. How has this worked out? He said, well, he said, there have been some problems with the people who have come from these shipwrecks, he said, but thank God we never had to rescue any Papists or Jews. Now, that was, of course, in character for that time, and it was quite a day to move from Plymouth Plantation to a groundbreaking ceremony for the Islamic Center in which the Cardinal of Boston, Cardinal Law, sent a personal representative to dig part of the hole for this new Islamic Center, joined by the president of the Board of Rabbis and the head of the Massachusetts Council of Churches. Is that Christ's work? The third story is I was in Florida for a program in which a prominent Palestinian and Israeli were speaking. This is my work for Peace in the Middle East with Jews, Christians, and Muslims. And we were in Temple Beth El in Boca Raton, and in the middle of Friday night service, which was attended not only by 500 or 600 Jews, members of this congregation, but also by 60 to 100 Muslims and Christians from Boca Raton who were attending Shabbos services on Friday evening. And when it came to the portion of the service where the Torah scrolls are carried through the congregation, if some of you have been to a Jewish service and this is the custom, the rabbi, I think not planned in advance, turned to Abdul Wahab Hashish, a Tunisian Muslim professor of the University of South Florida, and to me, a Christian, and gave us each a Torah scroll to carry through the congregation. And members of the congregation reached out and touched the Torah scroll and kissed their lips as we, a Muslim and a Christian, carried the Torah scroll through. On a lighter note, a group of Jews and Christians, American Jews and Christians, were gathered in Washington a year ago or so. And I believe it was a Jew, probably a Jew, who told this joke. I think it's probably easier for a Jew to tell it than for a Christian. But it went something like this. He said, you know, we're gathered together and we don't agree on whether the Messiah has come. Christians here think Messiah has come and Jews think he hasn't. We both think he's coming. Christians think it'll be again. Jews think it'll be for the first time. My thought is that we ought to put that aside and wait till the Messiah comes, and in the meantime, roll up our sleeves and involve ourselves in the project of tikkun, healing the world, healing creation. But he said, of course, and then when the Messiah comes, we can ask him, have you been here before? And he said, of course, I can already tell in our audience right now among the Christians and Jews, there's a certain anxiety as to, well, what will he say? Because the dispute continues, even though our sleeves are rolled up. So we will ask the Messiah, this question is a very important question, have you been here before? And the Messiah's answer might just be, that was a long time ago, I don't remember.
Okay, thank you. All right.
Is Christianity the only true religion? I have four opening points. One, no. Two, but Christianity is true. Three, we do not yet, as Christians, have the understandings that are requisite for adequately expressing the complexity and the mystery of truth in the religious realm in light of traditional Christian doctrine that allows us to give a full account of how it is that we are both a true way of life and other ways of, to God are also true. I think there are many promising starts, but I have yet to find a theologian who can articulate this in a way that I believe is fully adequate. So therefore, I have now excused myself from having fully to explain this. And I'm sure Dorothy, on the other hand, will be able to do that. But please don't feel pressured. Four. To say that Christianity is not the only true religion does not, to my mind, mean a total relativism, that anything goes, and that we can really create sort of one mega religion that's a smorgasbord. A little Christian this, and a little Jewish that, a little more Buddhist and Hindu and Native American, and that is not my understanding. I believe, as a practicing Christian, that serious and sustained encounter with the religious other is one of the most important ways of forming our own faith as Christians. And it seems to me that this is a very new thing in the history of Christianity. And one of the problems that I think we have, and one of the reasons that I think that before we have not been able to look at the truth in other religious traditions, is that we simply have not understood them in any adequate way. I know the most about the history of Christianity and Judaism. I know less about Christianity's encounter with other religions. But from what I do know, I can say that when we have described Jewish beliefs or Jewish practices, we have not done them as an insider. We have not gotten the insider's view. We have had a very distorted notion of what Jews think they're doing. And that one of the things that is incumbent upon us is the study of other religions with a much more sympathetic and empathic feeling. One scholar I know of talks about what he calls a sort of 50-cent term for late at night, a hermeneutic of the affections. That is, when we go before the religiously other, that one of the things that we must do is bring with it an interpretation of the other's faith that can listen to the loves of others, an ability to hear why they value their own religious tradition. In some of the dialogue groups that I have belonged to and led, one of the exercises that we give people, instead of immediately beginning with, well, what do you want to know about, what can I ask you about your faith if you're different, is to say, what would you like the other to understand about you? And by being able to articulate that for ourselves, it's the beginning of a much more promising dialogue. Now let me say just two more comments, sort of not a part of this list. I wanted to say something about what the adjective true means in the question. I don't know that this evening is a time for philosophical dispositions on the nature of truth. And I did not pray to Pontius Pilate for inspiration about this. So I thought what I might do, see if I could kind of get in and get out of this without losing my life here, would be to say how I think I might be using true this evening. That is, when I say Christianity is true, or Hinduism is true, or Judaism is a true religion, I mean something like this. I don't know that this is, I just sort of am working at this this afternoon here. By true, I mean a way of life that leads one to a profound sense of the sacred and to a desire to participate in making the world a more sacred place and the human community a more sacred people. A way of life is true when it provides the resources and the practices that form persons and community in worldly holiness, by which I mean a holiness that is transformative. I'm not saying this is a fully adequate definition of truth. It is only to say, it's only to stipulate how I happen to be using the word true at the moment. Finally, I would like to sort of close with a comment that has made a great deal of difference to me as a sort of a summary of my own experiences, and I resonate very much with what you've said, Ron, and I've been both, I go to Bene Gesserit once in a while, and I've been at Temple Beth-El, so I go there a ton. I mentioned that yesterday for those of you who were at my presentation. That's the one where they have the interreligious connection between the Catholic Church on one side and the temple on the other, because they have to share parking lots on the High Holy Days and on Christmas and Easter, and you see the beginnings of dialogue there. Diana Eck, who is a scholar of comparative religions, and in particular the religions of India in her marvelous book, Encountering God, has a line that goes something like this, that her encounter with Hindus, and you might substitute in another group with whom you are engaged, has enabled her to understand her own faith more clearly and also required her to understand her own faith differently. And I have found that to be very true of my own experience, that it really does force one to new understandings of Christianity. And for that, I'm grateful, because for me, my encounter with a religious other has enlivened my practice of Christianity, not led to a kind of a relativism. So I have no fear that a serious and sustained encounter with a religious other will diminish Christianity. In fact, I think quite to the contrary. It also means we might have to deal with some of the intolerance that has bedeviled us in our own history.
Thank you.
Now, if you can just solve the problem theologically, we'll be fine.
I cannot solve it, but I think I couldn't agree more with your criticism of the smorgasbord, or whatever it is you call it, or this anything goes.
I was trying to do something Scandinavian in here.
Yeah. And I'm always happy when some people at least have some criticism of postmodernism, and understand where it leads to ethically and as well as ontologically or in terms of knowledge, knowing, and then this anything goes, really, it doesn't go anywhere. This is exactly what we see. And I really think the only ethical question which comes out of the anything goes is keep your options open. This is so idiotic. But that is precisely the imperative which follows out of postmodernism. Mm-hmm. And I think we should not keep our options open, because that is impossible. We have already chosen, or we are already chosen. It's not true that we live as the Lord of ourselves, which is one of the basic truths of this postmodernity. And I think we, all religions have at their heart mysticism. And mysticism means, among other things, that it is not completely speakable. There is a limit where we have to go into silence, or we have to go as writers, for example, in paradoxes, or in other things which are not in the logic of our speaking alone. And this does not work. And I used this image when I was in this room, because the room invites to this image. If you think that there, in the center of the room, there is this X, some people call God, and others call divinity, or mother of us all, or whatever. There are many names for this X. But I don't want to talk only about that. I really want to talk about us, maybe the Christians living from here to here and going this direction to the X, and others coming from the unconsciousness of all living beings like Jung, or from other very different traditions. And they all try to reach out to the X. The point I wanted to make is, the more you are here in the beginning, where you have very specific rituals, words, figures, lifestyles, prayers, clothing, and all these others, the farther are you away from the heart. This is what Meister Eckhart calls always the manners, the modes in which we live religion. But you should love God and not the modes. you should love God more than anything else. And that means the deeper you, the nearer you come to this X, the nearer you come to the other people on their roads. Maybe when we would reach this inner circle here, it would be a big step forward, all of us. We would see each other better to begin with. We would understand each other better when we are closer to the secret of life. Then when we are here, and I would call this one the way, I think that mysticism and fundamentalism are opponents. Mm-hmm. These are the opposite sides. And fundamentalists are sitting here and say, my Bible tells me this, and my... That does not mean that we can undo these different ways. They are there, we have to use them. But the closer we come to the heart of the thing, the closer we come to each other. And the better is our understanding. That's one point I wanted to make. Another point which came to my mind when you were speaking, Mary, is really that there's this great Jewish philosopher Immanuel Levinas said, we live in the accusative. We are people spoken to. We are always in the presence of the other. And the ego-centeredness, which in a way undoes the other, doesn't work for us because we are called, spoken to. Martin Buber calls this the either-or relationship, which is one of the fundamentals of all religious life, and not only the Jewish Christian tradition, I think. We are not alone. Senses that when we claim our path as the only one, we destroy our own path to life. When we want to be winners with that, my husband quoted this wonderful phrase from Christa Wolf, the great German writer from East Germany, who lived in East Berlin. And she has a book, Cassandra, I think, that title. And in this book, there are some phrases about that the seeker is asked whether the city of Troya will survive. And he says, when you could finish to wish to win, then your city will survive. If you could stop to be winners or victors, if we would finish to understand our mission as being victors, if we could create a non-imperialist way of doing mission, we would be much better off and much closer to the heart of all things.
Thank you. Before opening it up, let me just mention that Encountering God, which was a book that Mary Boies mentioned, is, or at least was, available in the bookstore earlier today. And it is a very interesting book about Hinduism and Christianity and one woman's journey about that. And I think Dorothea has already touched upon one implication of some of the things I've said having to do with mission work. But there are many others, and you've come with many questions, and so it's open for you to question any one of the speakers, and the floor is yours. Yes, Bill.
To Mary, I always hear that passage as part of a family feud that as Christians began to emerge as an identity.
Which path?
I am the way, life, but I am the way and the truth. As Jesus, I don't believe, said that to begin with. I think that's the community. I think that's part of the family tension, the family feud. So I just, I say that because I remember the pastor's Berkeley study one night. One afternoon, one of the pastors just insisted on saying that, and a Jew who became a Christian pastor said, well, how do you know that? Because that's, I know the mind of God, that's the Bible. He said, well, how arrogant would you claim that you know the mind of God? And so what's helped me in this, with that passage, is to really believe that Jesus didn't say that. That's the early church talking for its own identity, its own purpose, its own needs. And so I can be open to my Muslim brothers, my Jewish brothers, whoever, and say that I do not have a claim of God. God has a claim on me. God has a claim on them too. But I really think we need to say more clearly in seminaries and in the pulpit that those are not Jesus' words, but are the words of the early church for a distinct purpose. And once we begin to understand what that distinct purpose is, then we begin to allow God's grace to touch us just a little bit more.
Well, maybe if I could kind of maybe delve at the question behind the question, I don't want to cut off the discussion, but that very often when Christians are first faced with dealing with whether or not other religious ways could be true, the first thing they might come up with is some scripture quotation that's going to refute it, and that's probably the classic one. Well, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And the problem is that asks biblical passages, it's a proof texting thing, taking it out of its own context, and then applying it to a question of our modern world that was not a question of the New Testament period in the same way. And so, I mean, in one way, it doesn't really matter whether it was the historical Jesus who uttered it or whether it's from the Johannine community or exactly what, that we can't solve the problem of religious pluralism by taking a verse here and a verse there. I mean, to me, that's a form of fundamentalism that just is not going to be of any solution in our time.
Furthermore, when the confession is made, Jesus is Lord, in the first or second century, Christians are in a very different position in history and in circumstances than we are now. Then, to confess that, one risks one's life. Now, to confess Jesus is Lord, the burden that confession bears is the burden of all the history of all the atrocities committed in the name of Christ. Mm-hmm. So it's a very different circumstance in which we confess those words or hear those words from the biblical text. Our circumstances are very different, and we can't but take responsibility for them. We can't act as if we don't live as bearers of that history.
But we do confess those words.
Yes.
I agree. I would like to say one more thing to this. In defense of the word, I am the way, the life, and the truth, I think this has not to be understood exclusively, but it can be understood as a song of love. Mm-hmm. When I say, the man I love is the most beautiful and the smartest and I don't know what else.
More time.
Aren't we jump to a conclusion on that?
All other men are ugly, dumb, and this is not my intention. And yet, the language of love, loves the superlatives, loves, needs the praise, needs the uniqueness. And if there is a justification of uniqueness, it has to do with love and with this. We call grace, which helps us and leads us, and our gratefulness flows then in those exaggerated words, which I don't. I agree with you that this is surely not the historical Jew named Jesus. It's the Christ of the early congregation and not historical Jesus. But this doesn't help us enough. We have to distinguish, I think, between some symbolic forms of language, of praise, which, when taken dogmatically, are untrue. Mm. But when taken as prayer, they are true. Mm. And that is, I have this terrible difficulty with why Christianity has developed basically linguistic forms of right heuristical phrases called dogmas, which are all coined after the laws of legal terms and thinking, and not have left the Jewish tradition, which was so much better, which is telling stories about God, which is much more important than reciting one dogma after the next and praying to God. These are the two true ways to come nearer.
Let me just ask a question that may speak what's on other minds and hearts here. All three of you seem committed to three views. One, that the answer to the basic question is no. Two, that it's important to maintain the integrity and the vitality of the religious traditions that you've named along the way. And three, that there's something deeply worrisome about the postmodern anything goes and anything is just as true as any other thing. But the third commitment does it seems to me, require that we still begin to make some discriminations. In other words, you want to move from the claim Christianity is the only true religion, which you want to deny, to there are other truths, other paths to this center. But you don't want to say that any starting point is a path to the center. So I'm wondering, do you mean to restrict the question simply to the what we might call the family of Abraham, Judaism, Islam, Christianity? Do you want to enlarge it to include Buddhism and Hinduism? You obviously don't want to enlarge it indefinitely to say that a lot of these ersatz new religions with almost no tradition and so forth, etc. So the point is that you want to still have some sense of discrimination and restriction, but you just don't want to draw the line narrowly around Christianity. And I'm wondering how you manage that. What are some of the criteria by which you say, here looks like a promising starting point to the center, and here does not?
Mm-hmm. I would say to that, the gift of the Jewish tradition to the world, families in the world, is to tell us that the way to God leads through the other, through the neighbor. Without neighbor, there's no way to God. Just looking inward and into the own ego, it wouldn't lead us to God. And I cannot give up that. And this compassion, belonging together, the great things in Buddhism, for example, need for me this concept of the otherness of the other. Why should this strange animal, my neighbor, be my path to God? And you have to think this was thought out in a clan society where people lived in extended families, clan-like, in which some rules were okay, but they didn't couldn't be used for other people. You could steal and betray and murder them. So there was no problem with that, no ethical problem. So, but when you break loose this neighbor, it's an opened door, and then soon it's not only the neighbor, it's also the foreigner. You see this in many places in the Bible. And then it's the enemy even. Mm-hmm. This is one line, neighbor, foreigner, enemy, and we are all one. Mm. And that is,
thank you.
I can't live without that.
Good. Yes, Mark.
I'd like to follow up on that a little bit and ask, the Christian church in particular is in a crisis of mission. Mm. We live in the world that you're describing, and we have become increasingly unwilling to say the words, Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, because perhaps of the history that we want to disavow. And yet we find, many of us find ourselves inexorably drawn to Jesus. We know that we are, in Martin Marty's phrase, descript rather than nondescript. So the question is, what is the nature of mission? You said that, you started to say that it's somehow through the neighbor, but you've also warned that there is always the temptation to imperialism. And so the question is, what is mission for us?
I'd like to respond to that.
Okay, here's a response over here.
I think it connects with the question about criteria. Because if we don't define the issue about criteria, what is truth, what leads us to the center, from any spoke of the wheel, then how can we ever talk about mission until we have that defined, about how we are to move toward the center? And if we start working on defining that criteria, how does our understanding of Jesus bring us in that direction? That then becomes our proclamation, it seems to me, rather than to say this person needs to follow Jesus, but this person needs to follow the kind of teaching, witness that Jesus made to the world that brings us to that center. I think these two questions are pretty much combined. And this one has to come first. We have to figure out what the criteria is, where how we define ourselves in the world and in relationship to other religions. We live in a situation, our Christian community has closer affinity to the Jewish, the Unitarian, and the very liberal UCC churches in our neighborhood than we do to the fundamentalist Christian church. The greater gap is between us and the fundamentalist Christians now than it is between the Jews, the Unitarians, religions in our neighborhood, Benai. So there's something about that connection, that openness, there's something going on between us that no one's been able to define. There's some openness, progression, but the criteria that draws us together has not been articulated by any of us. But there's something there. And to me, that needs to be articulated before we can return to mission.
Very nice. And we've started to get a little groping toward, I mean, with Mary acknowledging at the very beginning that there's yet to be some theologian who can really do that well, and then also, of course, Dorothée beginning to unpack a little bit of without neighbor, foreigner, enemy, and that is involved in our way to the center, then there's no authenticity to the religious, but there's a lot more work to be done, and there's some hands up, so.
And I was just, I guess, related to that, I think the analogy, the spoke to the center is very helpful, and you talk about the criteria and so forth. And I was responding to your comments about the mystics, because in my own reading or experience of not just, you know, monotheistic mystics, but also Hindu mystics, I mean, throughout time, the descriptions of God are virtually identical, and it's just almost striking how they all describe God as love, you know, whatever the tradition. My question is, I think that's right, that the center is this love, this gracious presence, but the difference is in how is that gap? I mean, I would say salvation, in a sense, the mystics might define it as proximity to God. My question would be is, how is that gap between us and God, love, how is that gap bridged? I mean, in a sense of salvation. I mean, that's where I would have to say that there's differences between the religions. And do we go to God through salvation and, you know, or I mean, through sacrifices or this ritual or that ritual, or does God come to us? And in that sense, there's different kinds of spokes, and there's a definite choice between traditions. And I don't know how you'd speak to that. I mean, are all bridges to the love center the same, or are some stronger than others?
Mm-hmm. Okay, Wilbert has wanted to get in on this issue. Can you begin to respond to his at all? Okay, why don't you're next as soon as, well, let me see if anybody can respond directly to Steve's question, which was, are all spokes to the center?
I think we can agree what God is, but how do we get closer to God? I would say different religions have different views.
You want to respond to
that? I want to add something to that, because I studied comparative religions like 45 years ago, and my understanding of Eastern religion is that there is an inhaling toward the negative and the denial of even existence. And to me, I've always struggled with the difference between going to a positive center and going to a negative center. And how do you put these together?
I just want to make a very modest response. This is where I think we are very quickly faced with our own ignorance about how other, what does a Hindu understand himself or herself to be doing in worship? You know, and you know, I'm not a comparativist. This is not my training. So all I know is that when I have had the opportunity to be with people of other religious traditions who are learned and who, to my view, seem to be, you know, holy people, not, you know, in the real sense of that word, not in the fake sense. All I can do is sort of sit in awe and try to understand what they are about. And so I think before we develop these criteria, which I do believe are important, we have a lot of learning to do from others. And one of the problems that I have, I think, with the religions of the East is that I'm a Westerner. And there are some things, I'm a Korean doctoral student I'm working with now. She's bicultural, really, and bilingual. And there are sometimes when she's talking about her dissertation that I know I don't really get what she's saying, even though she'll say, I'm not being clear. And I say, I think you probably are being clear, but I don't have the requisite background to really get what you're saying at the moment. You know, keep working on me, and maybe I'm trainable. But I think one of the problems in Christianity, we've been so insecure and so anxious to prove that we're the real religion that we've caricatured how other people believe. So my hesitation is, I do believe the criteria are important. I believe how we think about mission is crucial, but I think we can't rapidly race there. That's all. And I think what's important is that we have to learn we have to let any description that I make of another religious tradition should be able to be recognizable by the person in that tradition. That's our litmus test.
Okay, Fulbert, you have
something to say. To the mission, I had in my last theological seminars a Muslima, a wonderful young woman. And we spoke about praying, and our theological students were very reluctant. No, that is not our. And then this Muslima said, I will tell you something about my tradition. And I invite you to pray with me. And she bought some cups with her. And it was quite interesting what our students couldn't do out of her own tradition, they could do from the foreign tradition. What I'd like to say is that I think what this young woman did, that was a kind of public love declaration to her own tradition. She didn't like to make us to Muslim, but she showed what she loved. And I think when you love something, you can do it hidden. The big problem of homosexual people is that they are forbidden to show openly what they are. And I think a mission you could define as to show openly what you love. And I think people, without any intention, and especially not with the intention to win, but I think what the world really needs is people with a face, a group with a face, a group with a love. And so I have no problem with mission in this kind. That's the one point I'd like to make. The other thing, I don't like only the center, the X. I don't like my little segment, my V. When I'm a Christian, I made a decision.
Yeah.
I made a decision. This tradition is my first tradition. These books are my first books. These songs are my first songs. And I can change them to other songs. Mm-hmm. It's a problem we have in Germany now, that everybody would agree saying, yes, we all love the X. But our students, theological students, stand here and look at this X and this X and this X and don't know their own X. They are always camping in the gardens of the other religions. And I think what this student, this Muslima did, she learned us to love our own tradition. She learned, and so I think that's very, to make a decision and teach others and learn by others to love their own tradition. And I think that's...
Without nostalgia? Without nostalgia? You're talking about song.
Yeah.
Two songs that we sing in the churches where my wife has served during Holy Communion are As the Grains of Wheat, mm-hmm, and One Bread, One Body. Mm-hmm. And they are both about the unity. Mm-hmm. They are both about the unity. They can be sung in a way that is nostalgic for Christendom, mm-hmm, for Christian control, for Christian, for everyone becoming Christian, for winning. Or they can be sung about a unity that God is about, that we have a reflection of through our tradition that we deeply cherish, but is a unity that God is about that is so large, so awesome. And just listen, you know the words, but as the grains of wheat once scattered on the hill were gathered into one to become our bread, so may all your people, who are all your people? Are they all Christians? From all the ends of earth be gathered into one in you. Is this a softer version of Onward Christian Soldiers? I hope not. I hope the mission that we're about is not that, without the hard edge. And you look at one bread, one body, and there's some of the same questions it seems to me we should ask ourselves. What is the one body? And of course, one of the tricks that you can play on yourself is to become imperial in a soft way. You know, that they're not Christian by name, but we know they really are. Muslims play this trick sometimes, you're all good Muslims, they like to say. And it's a way of sort of absorbing us all into their tradition. So there's a danger of that. Anyway, I think of nostalgia in the sense of longing for an old way of hearing a song like this that means that we win out and we win you all over. And I hope that's not what mission is about.
I have a comment. I'm sorry, I'm up here. Sorry to make you turn around. I feel kind of like a kid in this conversation, and I am only 17, and I'm looking at this from a different point of view, I think, than a lot of people. I never went to college and studied this. I'm still in high school, and I've learned all along, and I'm going to take this a little different way, that everybody is a child of God, and that Jesus came to save all of us. And then I hear so much talk of the missionaries going down to places into Africa and South America and trying to convert the people into Christianity. And even if they're not trying to convert, but they go down, people go there and they share their views, and even if they're not intentionally disrupting the community, I see that there's a perfectly wonderful, say, African tribe there that has their own God that they worship and they feel resurrected and special to them, and we come in with our views and totally mess it all around. And I wonder if our mission as Christians is really to go in there and push our specific Western ideas onto them, or if it's to embrace them as fellow human beings and children of God and let them choose their own ways that they choose to worship. Am I making sense? I'm sorry. Am I?
And you know, there may be problems coming up when they think it's good to beat your children or to have polygamy. I have some questions about that. I wouldn't be honest if I would undo them or bury them, because it is, and I have problems with sexists, racists, heterosexists, or capitalist behavior. I think this is killing, and in a way, and it's I can't just say they have another lifestyle. I have to think about it. I mean, I have. I would like to be in a dialogue with the people, those people, and respect their traditions in that dialogue. But I would also have to ask them about their traditions.
Okay. Doesn't belong to tolerance, the possibility, the ability to find is not a. To say the truth, and I think nobody has a whole truth, not the Jewish, not the Christian, not the Muslim, but we have a part, and we are responsible for our part of truth. Even in Christian communities, we have only parts, and God is greater than our churches, of course. And so I think.
Thank God.
I think Catholicism has to quarrel with Reformed traditions about their kind of prayer and so on. And Reformation has to quarrel with Rome about the structure of Rome, of course. And so I think. We can't be only let one each other be. Love demands the truth, and maybe also
yeah,
not
the love.
Yes, you are.
Okay, we had a hand up here first, and then over here. Yes.
I'd like to share something that may shed a little bit of light from another perspective on this. I work. And have for the last 16 years at the Yakima Indian Nation on the Yakima Reservation in the southern part of the state. And it was a great surprise to me to learn that from their perspective, what they think about different religions, and I don't take this exactly literally, but if there's a truth in it that changed my way of looking at the issues we're talking about. They believe that God created a specific religion for each people when that people was created. And so when you come to their reservation and get to know them, the more traditional ones want to ask the question, what religion were you given? And of course they mean from your parents, but going back and back, they presume that somewhere along the line God gave you that religion. And that's the religion that you're supposed to follow. And that's so different than the way I was raised, which was, you know, that you're supposed to accept and practice the religion that you think is the most true religion. And obviously, if you think it's the most true, then you want to share it with other people. And it turns the issue kind of on its head. And I think what I've learned living with them is mission then for me is to be true to the religious tradition that I have. I think somebody else said that. That's, you know, what I've been handed, and as far as I can see in my life and the way I see things, this is the best way I can see it for me at this time, and to be honest and open about pursuing that, and then in the process of that, be open to watching them pursue spiritual growth in their religion and their tradition, and as we get to know each other, we all grow. And there are some aspects of Christianity that have been affected, I think, in a positive way. Some that haven't, but there's some positive way have affected their religious practices. And also, the opposite is true. Some of their practices and beliefs and paradigms have helped us. So to me, the question about going to Africa is more, if you would go now, and I think most missionary people I know in the Catholic tradition now, coming out of Mary Knoll, which is sort of leading the way and trying to rethink the mission spirit in the Catholic Church tradition, is that the world is becoming globalized. And so there are economic and sociological pressures on a tribe in Africa that they probably are not able to cope with without some additional assistance, because so much of that whole capitalist globalization can be so oppressive. And the first purpose of going is to simply be with them and share with them their experience of going through globalization, get to know their religious beliefs, their paradigms, share and try to preserve and, preserve is the right way, to deepen the Christian faith that the ones coming in have, and then share and respect it. And I guess what I think is that at that point, what Mary's saying will happen, that as we learn more from observing all the different ways that people have of finding God, we, the theologians among us, particularly in our interest, the Christian theologians, but in other faiths too, we'll be able to get new insights into what is this center and how do we all fit together working toward it.
Thank you.
I just wanted to throw in one other way of looking at the mission, and I've only encountered this idea relatively recently, so I don't know that much about it, but people have begun writing about the new creation, trying to pull together the breach in science in the last 400 years with the current religions. And one of the things that they finally say in its most simplistic form is that our mission is to enhance creation, and anything that we do that doesn't enhance creation should not be part of our mission. And so, you know, when you talk about going to Africa or something, there are obviously things that we should do. For female circumcision, there are things that are terrible that you might want to try to change, even though they're part of a culture, but a lot of other things not. But to me, it makes a lot of sense that if we look at the world as, and they, of course, look at the world as our body, not just our own human body, but the plants, the animals, the water, everything about the world, and that our mission as a religion, as a people, as a person, is to enhance that and never to diminish it. So.
Thank you. I've been pretty faithful in keeping faith with you night after night and saying we're going to go for an hour and then we're going to adjourn. I know this won't really be an adjournment, because I know from the number of you that are here and from the number of hands that have been up from time to time that there'll be more conversation. This is one of those times at Holden where I think we've seen Holden at its very best, which is to put out a question to sort of tacitly acknowledge that most of us are struggling with it. I think probably because in our world today, we've all grown to know and love, or will soon grow to know and love, people of other faith and other convictions. And many of us feel trapped in old conceptual schemes, to use a fancy word, or in old ways of thinking, to use a less fancy one, where we think that we have to choose somehow between a kind of absolutism on the one hand, or a kind of anything goes on the other, and that those are our only options. And one thing I've heard loud and clear tonight is that our panelists and many of you who have spoken think that both of those alternatives are equally death-dealing. They're different paths to death, the absolutist fundamentalist option as well as the anything goes option. And we've had people offer up
metaphors and pictures to begin to grope forward to different ways of thinking. We've had the wheel and the different spokes come up several times. We've just had from the Native Americans the whole notion that we were all given different religions when we were born. We've had alluded to the book From Bozeman to Benares, or Encountering God, which is the confluence of different streams, which is a kind of metaphor there. We need, in other words, different images that grow out of the depth of the spiritual imagination that different people, not just at Holden, but beyond from these other faith communities, can bring to the table to help us all move forward in this world together. And to continue to love one another as the gospel enjoins all of us to do. So I thank you all because I've learned a lot from all of you for your attention and faithfulness and for what I'm sure will be your determination to continue this conversation. Special thanks to all the panelists, and I hope you have a good night.